Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Lori Garrett with us today. Ms. Garrett is CFR's Senior Fellow for Global Health. She's the only writer ever to have been awarded all three of the big P's of journalism, the Peabody, the Polk, and the Pulitzer. She is a best-selling author, and her most recent book is I Heard the Siren Scream, How Americans Responded to the 9/11 and Anthrax Attacks. She has been a reporter for NPR and Newsday and has written for numerous publications, including the LA Times, Washington Post, Foreign Affairs, our flagship magazine, and Vanity Fair. Ms. Garrett has appeared on national television programs, including ABC's Nightline, Jim Lehrer, and The Charlie Rose Show. I hope you will follow her on her Twitter, at @Lori_Garrett, and she has her own website, LoriGarrett.com. Lori, thanks very much for being with us today. You recently authored an article in Foreign Affairs where you talked about the three big biology revolutions that are underway. It would be great if you could walk us through those and outline the positives and negatives of those revolutions that are happening.
Great. Thanks, Irina, and welcome aboard, everybody. Depending on which time zone you are, good afternoon or good morning. So there, those of you that are biology majors, there may be a few among you, or who have had your share of biology lab work, will find all this to be old hat, perhaps. But for the rest of you, this will probably all be news, because the changes underway in the world of biology are unfolding so rapidly that it just is head-spinning and almost impossible for even the most motivated individuals in the middle of the field to keep track. Three key things are occurring at the same time. The first is that the Human Genome Project, which was initiated in the 1990s and took 10 years, 160 laboratories, and $5 billion to successfully sequence the first human genome, the complete DNA sequence of a human being, sparked a whole revolution in DNA and RNA sequencing that today means that any one of you can go buy a sequencer for less than $10,000, stick it in your kitchen or a bathroom, and sequence your own personal genome in 24 hours or less for peanuts. And if you don't want to do it yourself, you can have a company do it for you. And nowadays, you can go to places like 23andMe and have all your DNA sequence done and look for specific genes, and the entire thing will cost you less than $400 and be done, you know, very quickly. So now biology has shifted from looking at the outside of microorganisms and wondering, well, if I throw some antibiotics in here, what do the bacteria do? To looking at the inside and imagining if you change the most elemental part of the inside, the DNA, what happens to the organism? And we have a massive sequencing effort going on with people out looking to sequence everything from the oceans and insides of volcanoes to the human gut and your eyeballs. And it's all about trying to figure out what is life and what's out there. And, of course, we're learning that what we're seeing with our eyes, it represents, an infinitesimal portion of what is life. It's a lot like the missing mass in the universe question, what's out there in outer space and what's the mass that's inside of an atom that we're not identifying. And the same is true in biology. The second big revolution underway at the same time is synthetic biology, which allows one to ask the question, if I just make up my own DNA sequence, just decide, here's a sequence, boom, I find a little bit of something from E. coli, a little bit of something from Salmonella, maybe this little phage DNA sequence, maybe a little something from a virus, and I mix it up. What do I end up with? And synthetic biology has now become so advanced that it's not only possible to create novel organisms or to alter organisms so substantially that they're no longer performing the sorts of functionality that they do in nature, but it's possible to solve major problems in the universe and in human health through synthetic biology approaches, so that you have everything from modifying organisms so that they produce energy and certain microbes can now be the equivalent of solar cells or even ethanol producers, to asking if organisms can play the role of warning systems. So, for example, a team of college students came up with an organism that senses arsenic in water and turns the water green and fluorescent if there's arsenic present. That would protect a lot of people that live in areas of contaminated water. And synthetic biology has now become so easy and so cheap, because all of DNA sequencing is now so easy and so cheap, that you have a competition, the iGEM competition, in which this last year more than 260 laboratories, high school and undergraduate college level, competed and came from, I believe, 60 countries in the world. And the competition was, can you take a basic toolkit of DNA pieces and proteins that will be supplied by the iGEM competition to you, and then whatever else you can get your hands on, and create an award-winning novel organism? So high school students and undergraduate college students are creating extraordinary novel organisms. Synthetic biology allows human beings to direct evolution. You don't have to watch evolution in a passive manner as Charles Darwin did more than 100 years ago. Now you can directly manipulate evolution, drive it in the direction you wish it to go, and drive it so fast that it's dizzying, the pace of things. Well, and this leads to the third big revolution that's unfolded, which is called gain-of-function research. So the premise of gain-of-function research, which is sometimes horribly referred to as GOF, not to be confused with goth for those of you that like to wear black. GOF research says, what if nature out there is about to throw a terrible epidemic at us or some other horror? Can we anticipate it by doing it ourselves in the laboratory and discovering what steps biologically are necessary to turn a somewhat dangerous organism into a very dangerous organism? This arose, this GOF issue, to great prominence a year and a half ago when a scientist from Holland was speaking at a meeting in Europe of other scientists and said, I did a very stupid thing, quote unquote, and explained that he had deliberately altered bird flu virus known as H5N1 into a form that could spread from one mammal to another mammal through the air. Now, presently in nature, this virus, which is very deadly if people do get it, it kills more than 60% of the human beings it infects. But presently, in its currently naturally evolved form, for the good of all of us, it doesn't spread easily through the air from one human to another or one mammal to another, between pigs, ferrets, mice, what have you. It is really a bird virus, and it's adapted to bird hosts. So the question that this experimenter from Holland was asking was, can I go in there and deliberately alter it and turn it into something that is adapted to spreading as potentially a pandemic flu that would be a very deadly pandemic flu in the world? And barely had he announced that he'd done this, then another scientist working at the University of Wisconsin, Yoshikawa Oka, said, well, he'd done pretty much the same thing, not the exact same experiment, but very similar, and also on the same bird flu virus, and that both labs had succeeded in making a form of bird flu that spread in the air between ferrets, which are used experimentally in place of humans. And this started a whole chain of events and controversies, as you can imagine. Why do this? Should this be done? Is it safe to do these kinds of things? If you do a gain-of-function experiment, should you publish how you did it? As one person sitting on the National Biosecurity Board put it at the NIH, if you publish it, are you giving a, quote, recipe for Armageddon to Al-Qaeda? And it suddenly became a full halt. Let's all step back and reconsider what we're doing here. For a while, the question was, should we just simply say you can publish your research, but don't publish the how-to section, what in scientists refer to as materials and methods. And Science and Nature magazine, the two most important publications in the world in this arena, both went through long soul-searching, many, many, many hundreds of meetings to decide, was it safe, was it correct to publish these findings and to publish how they were done? Well, of course, everything was published, and the whole field has skyrocketed forward so that now a Chinese lab in Harbin manufactured 127 novel forms of the H5N1 bird flu, and five of them spread through the air between guinea pigs in the lab and killed the guinea pigs. Now a petition has been filed. It's not clear to me why they filed a petition, since they don't have to get anybody's permission right now to do it, but filed by the Dutch researcher Ron Fouché and others, saying, we would like to do these experiments on the new bird flu that has emerged in China just this year called H7N9. This one is spread between people already, but in very rare circumstances. It is very deadly, kills about 35-40% of the people infected, and appears to be a very dangerous virus. So let's go make it more dangerous so we can anticipate what nature might do. Gain-of-function research, when combined with synthetic biology technology and sequencing, could very well be the way to open a door to a real nightmare set of scenarios for the future. On the one hand, we have the benefits for public health of knowing what nature might throw our way and possibly preparing, at least knowing what to look for, if not actually making vaccines and drugs that could offset it, which so far nobody's been particularly good at. But on the other hand, it means that a whole new toolkit has opened up that is cheap, is easy to do, and is affordable out there for people who may have more malevolent intentions, or simply sloppy people working in labs without taking appropriate precautions, resulting in the possible leakage of dangerous microbes into the community, into the laboratory environment, across the university campus, or wherever it may be going on. And if you think that that sounds wild, keep in mind we've had two SARS epidemics. The first one arose from bats through civets in a natural and terrible process in 2003 that resulted in a pandemic in 31 countries. The second one was the result of a laboratory accident in the CDC laboratory in Beijing. This is the Chinese CDC, that resulted in infection of people in the lab and outside as infected lab workers infected people in Beijing. In the United States, our high security laboratory network, which is now huge since 9/11, has just exploded in size and covers literally hundreds of facilities around the United States. Has witnessed more than 100 accidents involving the leakage of dangerous microbes that were being studied infecting human beings in one way or another. So this kind of new, brave new world we're heading into, combining the three big revolutions in biology, again, metagenomic sequencing, synthetic biology, and gain-of-function research, combined, pose really serious possibilities for what we call dual-use research of concern, meaning your intentions may be positive and may really lead to medical breakthroughs, public health breakthroughs, all sorts of things that would offset climate change impact and so on. But the very same identical experiments could, in the wrong hands or in sloppy hands, have dire consequences. And so this is what I was trying to address in a policy way in the foreign affairs piece.
Thank you, Lori, for that comprehensive and, albeit frightening, overview. Let's open up to the students for questions, and we will go around the country.
Okay. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
Lori, while we wait for questions, given the potential for laboratory accidents that you reference, what do you think is the best strategy to allow this important research to continue while minimizing the threats to global health?
Well, I've come up with a list of several things that I think the United States government and other governments around the world, steps that should be taken by everybody. And that is in the form of a policy innovation memorandum that we have published, which is available on the CFR website. I don't know if this was part of the package of things the students saw. One key take-home message is no one country can take action unilaterally with meaningful impact. It's got to be that the whole world comes to grips with this issue. And part of the problem with the whole world coming to grips with it is that we don't even have shared definitions of anything that we're dealing with. For example, we currently have a categorization system in the United States for four different categories of laboratory safety. So biosafety level 1 would be, you know, a high school lab or a typical undergraduate college teaching lab. Biosafety level 2 would go up a notch. A little more caution would generally be only in an active research laboratory. Biosafety level 3 goes up considerably. Now you're wearing gloves and you're wearing a mask and you've got a special ventilation system and you can't eat at your lab site, and nobody can visit you inside the lab, and the lab itself has security precautions and so on. And then all the way up to biosafety level 4, which is, I worked on the movie Contagion. Some of you may have seen the Steven Soderbergh film a couple of years ago starring Matt Damon. And if you saw it, then you saw biosafety level 4 laboratory work at the CDC. And this is in a full body suit. You have a dedicated air stream coming inside your suit. You are inhaling and exhaling air that is going through a mass scrubbing device so that your air, literally, if you got infected, could not infect others. Everything in the facility is on lockdown, and there are several layers of security involved. Well, in terms of trying to come to some global understanding about all of this, we don't even have shared definitions inside the EU, between European countries, of what is a BSL-3 lab, what is a level 4 lab, what is a level 2 lab, what kind of research is allowed to go on in which kind of laboratory. We don't have agreement between U.S. standards and European standards, between Chinese standards and Japanese standards, and so on and so forth. And therefore, we don't even have sort of basic ability to define the problem and then set regulatory systems around the problem. So the first big step is to just come to some agreements about how we define laboratory safety, how we define the nature of the problem, and then move from there.
Okay, we currently have a question in the queue. Before I let the question be asked, I just wanted to remind everyone to ask a question, just press star 1. And our first question comes from Monterey Institute of International Studies.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. I was wondering if you could comment on the kill switch proposal for gain-of-function research, where the pathogen is modified to increase our ability to disable it if it is released accidentally. Do you think this is currently technically possible and politically viable? Thank you very much.
That's a terrific question, and just so that everybody's up at the same level and understands what we're talking about, there are two biological approaches to limiting risk. One is to put in a so-called kill switch or a suicide switch so that if you're going to create a modified organism that you think is potentially dangerous, you've got something that you've built into the DNA that is a very simple way to basically make those organisms kill themselves, you know, commit suicide, and almost all cells in your body have kill switches in them. And it's when they don't work that you get things like cancer. The other is to do what we call barcoding. Now, you've all seen barcodes that when you buy something at the store and they swipe it over the reading device, the UPC codes. Well, the idea would be to do something along those lines in microorganisms where there is an identified DNA sequence you've stuck in to whatever you've created, whatever synthetic biology you've executed, that says, you know, this is made by so-and-so, or this is a fake organism that I made. When Craig Venter made the first man-made bacteria that self-reproduced, he put in the names of all the scientists on his team as a DNA-coded message. So if that ever escaped from his lab, all he would have to do is do a search sequence for that code set of names, and he could find it. So the questions are twofold. One, can this be done? Yes, of course it can. That's the technology part of it, is not the hard part. The question is whether it would effectively eliminate risk or minimize it enough that it's worthwhile to call for this as a universal standard of behavior. Well, yes, in the sense that for legitimate research where our primary concern is leakage or accidents, putting in some form of identifier labeling and or a kill switch would greatly enhance our ability to at least keep the accident from turning into a community event. So if you've got a research lab in Monterey, let's say it's up at UC Santa Cruz, and somebody makes a mistake, public health authorities, investigators, CDC would all know, you know, this is your search cue, this is what you're looking for genomically to identify the presence of it, or here's what you have to do to turn the kill switch on. And that would be some small biological event, such as raising the pH or putting in a bunch of CO2 in the solution or something of that nature. The problem is it doesn't help you for anybody that's got a malevolent intention to begin with, because a bad guy isn't going to put a kill switch in, and a bad guy isn't going to put a sequence marker in or a barcode. So while it may help on the accident side of the equation, it's not going to help on the deliberate bad guy side.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from the University of Kentucky. University of Kentucky, the floor is yours.
Hello, Kentucky.
Hi. Hello, Kentucky. Huh, okay. Maybe they're having technical difficulties.
Okay, there are currently no other questions in the queue.
Okay. Lori, what are the most important steps for the international health community to take to be prepared for pandemics? We are obviously entering into a season, and I'm sure that this is a topic of discussion on campuses across the country as well.
Well, actually, right now we have an outbreak of meningitis at Princeton University among students. We have outbreaks of a number of different things on different college campuses right now. One of the problems we're facing is that more and more kids are showing up as freshmen at universities and living in dormitories or joining sports teams. In both cases, therefore, having a lot of potential physical contact with other students. And these are kids that have not been fully immunized in their childhood against really basic illnesses like polio and measles. And so we're getting outbreaks because those kids become carriers, bring it to college campuses, and if other kids on the campus have either not been fully immunized or somebody made a mistake and they missed one of their booster doses as a kid for, say, diphtheria, or they're just unfortunate in terms of their immune system being weak and not having a strong enough response, you get outbreaks on college campuses. And we're seeing more and more of this because of the anti-vaccine movement around the United States. And in Europe, there, it's really even a more serious problem. And this is, you know, it's a classic problem where the highest risk seems to be in the richest communities. It's the richest families that are refusing to vaccinate. And it's therefore the fancy universities that are facing the problem the most because the rich kids show up unvaccinated or only partially vaccinated due to this completely bogus, absolutely 100% fallacious belief that somehow you get autism as a result of vaccination. Completely ludicrous. No basis in scientific data or fact whatsoever, but widely spread by celebrities and movie stars and one particular scandalous physician in England. Overall, globally, and I discuss this in some of the writings that you were looking at, our real problem in dealing with responses to pandemics and our ability to see it in time and take appropriate actions to protect as much of humanity as possible was revealed very clearly in 2009, so 4 years ago at this time, when the H1N1 so-called swine flu was spreading. It started in the Midwest of the United States in hog farming and spread from hog farm sites to county fairs where folks come and pet those pigs, and the people got it from the pigs, and then presumably as a result of migrant laborers working in Midwest pig farming but then returning home to Mexico, it really exploded in the spring of 2009 in Mexico, and we had this huge swine flu pandemic that swiftly spread from Mexico across the United States and then everywhere in the entire world in a matter of weeks. Fortunately, this was not a terribly lethal virus. It was, as flu viruses go, pretty run-of-the-mill. I, at the time, called it a wimpy virus. It was not wimpy if you were a pregnant woman. For pregnant women and their fetuses, it was a very, very dangerous virus, in fact. But for most of the population, it was an uncomfortable virus. People got very sick and felt lousy for a few days, but it was not life-threatening and was just experienced much like a routine seasonal flu. What the 2009 situation showed us, however, was just how ill-prepared the world is. First of all, country after country executed policies that are completely contrary to all international agreements. So, for example, they shut down airports, or they wouldn't permit certain kinds of countries' planes to land. Planes from Mexico and the United States landing in Asia were quarantined. In some cases, all the passengers were put in isolation facilities. In some cases, they refuse to let the plane land longer than to simply refuel and go back to Mexico or back to the United States. Many countries put thermal detectors in all their airports and their train stations and so on that were intended to catch people with fevers. And if you had a fever, you'd be pulled aside and put in some kind of a quarantine or isolated from others. And, of course, in the case of flu, that's a silly precaution because influenza is actually contagious before people have any fever or have any idea that they're even sick. So that's just a way of being violating individuals' civil liberties, but with no real impact on protecting society at large. We also saw a mad scramble for available vaccines and drugs. And as it turned out, it took more than 6 months to get decent vaccines made. By then, our epidemic in the United States was already pretty much over. And the Mexican epidemic was long over. Most of the humans on the planet never did get vaccine, and most got it, if they did get it, after their epidemic threat had already passed. So 2009 taught us that we don't have a machine in place to produce vaccine in a timely fashion and in an equitable fashion that's available to all the people of the planet, regardless of whether they happen to live in a rich country or a poor country. And the same was true with the only drugs that we know are at all effective or have any impact at all on your survival in the case of a pandemic flu or other potential pandemic viruses. Those are patented drugs. The companies refuse to allow generic manufacturers to augment production, even in a crisis. And since they are patent drugs, the companies could set whatever price they wanted, and it was unaffordable to all but the richest countries in the world. And the richest countries in the world, including the United States, bought up and created huge stockpiles of these drugs and did not make them available to the poorer countries of the world or even the middle-income countries like Mexico, which was suffering at the time. So what that 2009 episode taught us was, A, we got caught by surprise. A surveillance system, even in the richest country in the world, the United States, failed to anticipate and spot the virus until it was already fully adapted to being a pandemic strain and had already crossed into another country. B, vaccine was not available for more than 6 months, and when it was available, the amount was so small that it was only for a trivial percentage of the world population, and there were no mechanisms in place for getting vaccine to poor countries in a timely fashion, which totally annihilated all global solidarity. Number three, drugs were not widely available or affordable. And then finally, you know, all the mechanisms of kind of a solidarity across the nations for a shared risk and shared response completely broke down. So by looking at the 2009 episode, we can see what we don't want to repeat. We can see where the errors and the flaws are. It's a good thing we had that experience with a weak virus, but I can't tell you that a whole lot has improved since then, and that if the H7N9 virus, which just appeared in China about 9 months ago and has returned after disappearing over the summer, is now back again. I can't tell you if that virus figures out how to turn into a pandemic strain, if it makes the appropriate mutations and manages to spread, that our global response would be any better now than the lousy response that we saw in 2009.
Thank you. Let's go to questions.
Okay, again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question comes from the Monterey Institute of International Studies.
Hello, thank you. You mentioned the IGEM students, and I was wondering if you think this kind of project can be a good solution to address security issues, and what would you expect from the student to see, and what kind of aspect of security would like to see tackled by the students in the context of their projects? Thanks.
Are you asking about the iGEM competition itself, or in general?
I mean, I'm starting from the idea of the competition of iGEM, but generally, like students that like to work in synthetic biology, or how can they integrate
right.
security in their work? That's basically my question, I think.
Okay. Well, the iGEM competition is pretty fantastic. I mean, I wish I were in my 20s and I could be in this world. Back in my day in the lab, things were not so exciting. And I think the kids are coming up with just, you know, really amazing stuff. One of the things that's been heartening is to see that some of the kids have put attention to trying to use synthetic biology to come up with ways to make the whole process safer, coming up with organisms that might be able to detect a novel, unusual viruses or organisms that have auto-destruct signals in them or various other kinds of models that allow law enforcement and laboratory safety personnel to keep track of what's going on and to intervene if something looks inappropriate or dangerous. And that's terrific. And I do think that synthetic biology has within its very toolkit the ability to lessen the risk of its own work, if you will, if you're following what I'm saying. And as more and more young people get engaged and start thinking about how to use synthetic biology techniques to, you know, monitor and respond to the risk, I say, hooray, go for it. You know, that's fantastic. And I, you know, one thing I want to be really clear about, because some people have been very critical of this aspect of my writing, you know, my job is to look at risk and try to figure out where the dangers are and what might be suitable for alleviating or mitigating those dangers. That means that sometimes my stuff comes across pretty negative. I don't want people to think that my take-home message is that synthetic biology is inherently a bad thing. On the contrary, I think this is the most exciting new revolution in biology since Charles Darwin. And I am a true believer that when you marry 3D printing to synthetic biology, as is now being executed by Craig Venter's lab and by several companies that are working on that as an approach to pandemic response, vaccination production, and so on, I think we're heading to a time in the not terribly distant future when a lot of things that we consider dire diseases today will be very ho-hum. For example, if someone has type 2 diabetes and their entire pancreas is dysfunctional and insulin production is completely out of whack, we could be looking at a time in the not terribly distant future when the synthetic biology technology and 3D printing can be married in such a way that we 3D print for you a pancreas that is based on your DNA, and therefore there's no immune system rejection issue, and the end result is that you're completely cured. We're already looking at efforts to come up with 3D printed kidneys for people that are on dialysis, heart valves. One group's even tried to 3D print an eyeball. I think we're headed down an exciting path. So please don't think that the take-home message here is that I'm anti-science or I think something's terrible inherently about synthetic biology. But we do have risks to consider, and the more young people get in the field and start looking at how to mitigate those risks and how to use the technology itself to lower the risk threshold, I say bravo, and I think it's doable. I think there are a lot of technological solutions that can be brought to bear.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1, and our next question comes from Pepperdine University.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah,
that's okay, so my question is, in terms of global preparedness, what's your take on the strategy to look for novel viruses that are that have yet to be identified in mammals, to kind of try to take one step to get one step ahead of being caught with the next new SARS or the next new Middle Eastern respiratory virus.
Yeah. You know, it's very exciting that there's now a lot of talk at the NIH and so on about doing the equivalent of the Human Microbiome Project as a sort of virome project, a world virome. So the idea is to try and mass sequence for viral particles all over the world in all different kinds of ecological settings and basically come up with a genomic encyclopedia of all known viruses on Earth. That would be an unbelievably ambitious undertaking, of course, because I think most virologists and public health experts would agree we probably only actually know now somewhere south of 5% of all the viruses on Earth, and it's probably below 1%. And what we know best are viruses that have dramatic impact on human or animal health. And what we don't know much at all about are all the viruses out there that indirectly affect our lives and our environments by their impact on other microbes, larger microbes, or on plant and animal species that we don't pay a lot of attention to, particularly those that are in ecologies that humans find difficult to work in, such as the bottom of the ocean or the top of a mountain or inside a volcano or what have you. Nevertheless, I think it's a really exciting potential, and I certainly know a number of scientists that are strongly pushing for it and searching for the funding to make this happen. The bad news is I think sequestration and budget cuts at the federal level that have affected the NIH and the National Science Foundation have really put a damper on, you know, big project proposals for the moment. And there's a real scramble to figure out how any of these sorts of things can get funded. I could right now tell you about quite a number of labs, really top-notch, best scientists on the planet labs that are scrambling just to keep the lights on right now. So I guess my answer to you and Pepperdine is, yes, I want to see this happen. I think it would be fantastic. There certainly are risks, you know, finding a strange new virus. It always poses the risk that it may have the ability to do something to the human body that you didn't anticipate, or to your pets, or to livestock, or plants. But nevertheless, such a catalog would be of far more advantage to humanity than disadvantage. The question is, you know, who's going to pay for this, and how are we going to make this happen, and what are going to be the rules around, you know, how the research is executed, and where does it all reside? And that's not a trivial question, given that barely was the ink dry on the report in The Lancet in September of a new virus in Saudi Arabia that had affected an individual in the UK, which we now call the MERS virus, or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome virus. Barely was the ink dry when word was out that the Dutch team, which happens to be the same team that had been doing the gain-of-function research on H5N1 flu viruses, that team had done the sequencing on the MERS virus and had put it in a legal status that is somewhere in between being patent-pending and investigational use only. But regardless, all of a sudden there was talk of, well, if you discover a virus, you can claim it and own it and have some kind of a bizarre legal status over who gets to use it, look at it, and work on it. And this whole issue of patenting of life forms and patenting of viruses and trying to set limits on who gets to try and make a vaccine based on it or a product based on it has become a political hot potato all over the world, has proven deeply divisive between nations and in international responses to global public health. And I think it's really heinous difficult problem, one that we have not resolved, and it's got to be built into any large-scale project of the ambitious scale of, you know, creating an encyclopedia of the genetics of all known viruses on Earth, anything of that nature. It's got to have built into it that if, as a scientist, you're going to be a participant, I don't care what country you're in, you relinquish patent rights, and you will not seek to patent the genetic sequences that you produce, and you will understand that this is all for humanity. Shared use, shared benefits, shared risks.
Lori, in your foreign affairs article, you talk about the collision of symbio and technology. Can you walk us through this and discuss the ways in which they overlap?
Synthetic biology and what?
Synthetic biology and technology.
Something's missing here. Did you say synthetic biology and 3D technology?
Well,
I'm sorry.
I just said technology, but yes.
Well, I mean, synthetic biology is technology. So I'm not sure I get the question. There are quite a number of ways that synthetic biology can replace existing technological approaches to problems like production of energy, and that is the hope of the future of synthetic biology. Folks like Craig Venter are working on that problem right now, trying to, I just saw, for example, a South Korean group, university-based group, has come up with a way to modify E. coli so that its primary waste product from whatever processes the E. coli may be digesting ATP and so on, its primary waste product is straight ahead fuel scale ethanol. That's pretty exciting. I mean, if you could just produce ethanol in the equivalent of the kind of fermentation plants that we currently have to make beer, then, you know, that could result in a scale of energy production that would be cost effective and would get us around petrochemicals and lower our damage to our atmosphere and slow the pace of climate change. All of that is good. And all of that would be great. But you can also weave a lot of scenarios where the marriage of industrial scale technology and synthetic biology could be very dangerous. And I don't think I have to weave a lot of scenarios to get everybody's imagination going in that direction, too.
Next question.
Okay, our next question comes from the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M University. And please remember that if you'd like to ask a question, just press star 1.
Hello, Texas.
Hi, Joe Cerami from the Bush School. I'm curious about the international dimensions of what's going on in the world of advanced science and technology. Who'd you say are the other countries in the world besides the United States that have research and development programs in this area that are cutting edge?
Yeah, well, of course, it won't surprise you that the U.S. is in the forefront because our NIH dwarfs all other government sponsorship of basic science research, even with the cutbacks that Congress has made, which have been very serious. We still are the powerhouse of the planet. And if you combine what our private sector is doing, most of which, of course, is secret because it's hidden behind the veil of trade secrecy, we know that the United States is way out in front. But racing to catch up and in less regulated environs are several of the Western European countries, Germany and the UK in the forefront, Japan, and, of course, China. And in China, they have a distinct advantage, which is that because sequencing of genomes has become so cheap and so automated, a lot of American and European investigators actually outsource the sequencing part of their lab work to Chinese labs. And the largest of those companies that receives such orders is called Beijing Genomics. They're they have laboratory facilities with, you know, acres of automated sequencing devices located outside of both Shanghai and Beijing, and vast reserves of identified sequence data in their computers. There is a very aggressive effort in China to not only catch up, but to take the lead on a lot of this kind of work. And all you have to do is look at the simple math that, you know, two labs, one Dutch, one American, made some modest gain-of-function changes in the H5N1 genome and then, you know, moved on to other research, while one lab in China, you know, manufactured 127 novel forms of the virus and did so under the radar with nobody knowing they were working on it, even authorities in Beijing, and then announced it to everybody's astonishment, all of it achieved within a matter of weeks of the publication of the how-to sections on in Nature and Science of the two original laboratories. So the catch-up game is happening. A lot of different parts of the world are in key positions. And I should also, since you ask about the international dynamic, mention a downside, another breaking point on the sort of global solidarity around this, and that is that when I talk to leadership in different kinds of countries, I hear very different interpretations of the risk-benefit equation of these big three revolutions in biology. In the wealthier parts of the world, the risk-benefit equation it's positive, but we need a regulatory environment. We need to figure out how to regulate the safety and know who's doing the work and build in, you know, barcodes and kill switches and et cetera. When you go to the so-called BRICS countries, the rising superstars of the world economy, countries like China, India, Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, South Africa, and so on, their attitude is, this whole regulatory regime that you're talking about is just another way that the old wealth world is trying to hold down the emerging wealth world. You're trying to regulate and stifle us to the advantage of the rich world, and we don't like it one bit, and we choose not to participate. And then from the poorer world, the majority of humanity, really, but represented by countries ranging from, El Salvador to Malawi, the response is, all this is going to end up doing is being one more way that we get held back, because you're going to build regulations related to immigrant scientists and visiting scientists, trying to minimize risk and keep track and make sure that nobody supporting Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group gets into your labs in the United States and Japan and England and so on. And it's just going to be one more way that our people don't end up not being able to have access to new technology and new science, and holds us back. So we have to figure out meaningful ways to break down the divides, in this sort of tripartite divide or three-way split that keeps us from being able to address the problem, and break down all these suspicions that ultimately are all based in economics.
Thank you. Next question.
Okay, our next question comes from the University of Connecticut.
You spoke before about the ineffective response to the swine flu outbreak in 2009. I was just wondering, in response to that, then, other than developing an effective vaccine, what is the proper way for governments and law enforcement to respond to such an outbreak? Like, say the MERS virus grows to pandemic levels unexpectedly, or maybe expectedly by some people, not expectedly by governments. What is the effective response to that, if not to curtail civil liberties?
Very good question, and one that occupies mountains of public health literature and is the subject of enormous debate. You know, first there's the what's the right thing to do, and then there's the political realpolitik, what will be done. Absolutely no political leader, whether it's the mayor, unless he happens to be the mayor of Toronto perhaps, but the mayor or the governor or the head of state or a senator or what have you, no politician wants to be blamed for allowing an epidemic to unfold on their watch and allowing a death toll on their watch. And as we can see all around the world, very few politicians come out well after a catastrophic disaster that is visited by nature, whether it's an epidemic or Hurricane Sandy or what have you. The public watches every word and expects an enormous amount from political leadership in times of trouble, especially when those times of trouble have a lot of fearfulness built around them. And there's very little that people are as afraid of as mysterious epidemics. I think it's built into our DNA, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, if you imagine us as hunter-gatherer clans roving around, seeing mysterious deaths and illness is something that we basically got avoided by running away. And that would be our response. You see a strange death, you run away, you run the other way. But as countries and as global institutions, there's no run the other way. It's not doable, and it doesn't make sense. Unfortunately, most countries will continue to take policies that are not terribly different from, you know, the kinds of policies that were executed as the plague spread across Europe in the 14th century. And it's all like trying to keep the microbes at bay by limiting human movement and quarantining people and closing borders and so on. But in the age of globalization, air travel, et cetera, those sorts of measures make no sense whatsoever. They're all part of ancient history. The problem is that we really need to build up systems that enhance global solidarity, enhance the ability of nations to work together to share solutions, share strategies, including drugs and vaccines, in a timely manner, share the science in a timely manner. And the barriers that are in the way, like patent regimes that allow people to try to invoke ownership of viruses, have to be broken down. That's the first step. I do think there's a lot of active discussion of this. There's a very high level of awareness in the global health community about the risks inherent in having so much of pharmaceutical technology concentrated in such a small number of countries, and so much of the capacity to make vaccines really located in only 5 or 6 countries on the planet, and 5 or 6 companies on the planet. And I think there's a really, you know, awakening emerging that this is a risk to all of humanity, and that it's even greater when you get into things like, what about a virus that would kill all wheat? What about a virus that would kill, or a bacterium that would kill all rice? And what does it mean to global food production and starvation and solidarity if we can't come up with ways to work together collectively and recognize that in a globalized world, one man's virus is every man's virus?
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question.
Okay, our last question comes from Colin Powell Center for Leadership and Service.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for speaking to us today. I was wondering if you thought that the pandemic influenza preparedness framework has done anything to make progress in breaking down the barriers between countries to share knowledge and intellectual property, and if there is any legislation in the making to help foster more communication of knowledge between different countries.
Great question. So for those of you that may not be aware of the background behind this question,
good afternoon, everyone. Could I have your attention?
The World Health Organization is governed by an entity called the World Health
Organization. We'll get started in just 30 seconds.
Every nation is a member, And every nation has one vote. So Vanuatu has as much political clout as China. Not a proportional representation. It took about 14 years of debate in the whole World Assembly process to come up with the international health regulations, which were finally ratified in 2005 and went into effect a few years later. But along the way, trying to implement the international health regulations, which, among other things, call upon nations to be completely open and transparent about epidemics, no cover-up as China did in 2003 with SARS, and to allow international assistance to come in, to allow laboratory sharing of samples, all of this. Well, this all became problematic when Indonesia, under a prior leadership than currently exists in the country, declared the notion of viral sovereignty. So they declared that if a virus is first found in any given country, whether or not that's where it originated, you could never even prove that. If it's found on Indonesian soil, it's an Indonesian possession, and Indonesia as a government has sovereignty over all uses of said virus, regardless of whether or not it has pandemic potential and could endanger all of humanity. And in such a circumstance, they would argue, they did argue, that any sharing of viral samples, this was related to bird flu, had to be cleared by the government, and it had to be proven that whoever was receiving said samples would never make a vaccine or a product based on it without negotiating royalties in advance and how the Indonesian government would get their fair take from the equation. This endangered all aspects of virus sharing and anticipation of epidemics and pandemics. And, you know, the whole system broke down. And for a period, almost no bird flu viruses were getting analyzed and shared in anticipation of a possible pandemic from any but about four or five countries in the world. And eventually, especially a unique agreement was reached between, you know, forwarded by Indonesia in negotiations with WHO, resulting in a new special, you could think of it as a flu add-on, virus sharing add-on to the international health regulations. And things do appear to be better since that agreement was reached, better in the sense that no country is openly refusing, as a matter of political agenda, to share samples or to participate in surveillance for new diseases. However, if you look at the data banks and how many outbreaks we know are happening versus how many samples have been submitted for to international data banks, we're way, way, way behind still. We have a long ways to go before you can say that in a timely fashion, samples are indeed reaching international share levels where everybody can take a look and figure out what's going on.
Lori, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today, and I apologize to those. I know there are a few more questions on the line, but we are, in fact, out of time. So I'm sorry that we could not get to you. We hope you will join us for the final call of the semester, Wednesday, December 4th. Daniel Markey, our Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia, will talk about U.S.-Pakistan relations. So I hope that you will follow us on Twitter at CFR_academic and follow Lori Garrett on her Twitter feed at Lori_Garrett. We look forward to having you join us for the last call of the semester and hope that you have a great Thanksgiving break in the meantime.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.